one of the ways that we can think about spiritual practice, Buddhist practice, Dharma practice, yogic practice, is a process of purification where we recognize, this is the beginning of the path, we recognize that there are aspects of our own conditioning, our own actions, our own habits and patterns that unchecked are causing stress and suffering and pain in the world and in our own experience. And this recognition can hinge on, in a sense, two related realms of recognition. One is the recognition that my own actions bear fruit and they have a direct impact on my own happiness, my well-being going forward. So then, you know, my actions, meaning like there's just ways that I can practice, ways that I can use my attention primarily to uproot those deep habits and patterns that cause so much pain. Patterns of grasping and fearing, wanting, hatred, confusion. So there's the aspect of liberation practice that hinges on, like, what do I do in relation to my own actions? How do I practice? And then there's the aspect that recognizes conditionality, which is the same principle, but in the broader sense. So it recognizes that what's happening now is the product of conditions from the past. And what happens in the very next moment from now is the product of conditions from the past plus whatever I do in this moment. And that's all that there is, right? What you have is you have access to, you know, this body, these words, and the actions that you can do volitionally. And of course, volitional action, doing things on purpose, is only available when you have your hands on the wheel of the vehicle of your life. And the whole thing about habits and patterns and the unconscious, avidya, not knowing, ignorance, is there's all these things that we don't have our hands on the wheel for. So there's all these forces that come through us that didn't begin with us, that are ancient, that we were taught to do, that were conditioned, that are habits from our life based in trauma, based in delusion. But we keep doing them, you know, the ways that we act unconsciously. And so then the recognition that the unfolding of the whole process for myself, for others in relationship, hinges on seeing that what's conditioned is conditioned and constantly changing, and seeing that my actions are the only thing that I have a handle on. And then that the only way I have a handle on them is if I find the handle, basically. If that's the case, then the whole of the practical aspect of the path, like the things we actually do, the thing that practice consists of, is doing whatever we can intentionally so that we are more often awake than asleep, or more often have our hands on the wheel than not, more often conscious of our actions than unconscious. And then that when we are choosing actions, when we're conscious of our actions, that we learn to choose what's wholesome or skillful or beneficial for ourselves and others. And this was long called a purification, because it was clear that the forces that we were struggling against were toxic or fiery or poisonous in a certain way. And I've started to think of, you know, in Buddhism, there's the term the three poisons. It might originally have referenced the three fires, three things that burn. These are the forces, they're basically like archetypal emotions that are behind all of the suffering that we experience, behind our own actions that cause suffering. Greed, hatred, and delusion, they are. And so greed or grasping or attachment, grabbing onto things, so holding onto the pleasurable, trying not to let it go, holding on to relationships or activities or things, states, essentially, in our being. So grasping, which includes wanting, but really it comes into its fullness when there's this kind of clench. And then aversion or hatred, pushing away, fearing is part of this. Often in relation to the painful or the uncomfortable or the unsatisfying, we push it away. You know, I try to not have it. I try not to be exposed to that which hurts. And then delusion, is both the kind of confused mind that doesn't know what's happening, but it's also the mind in denial, that doesn't want to admit what's true, that would rather be numb or washed out than present with that which is painful. So grasping, aversion and delusion, the old Victorian translations that are appropriate were lust, hatred, and delusion, or confusion, ignorance. And so these are called these great poisons, and there can be this sense that I have to uproot those from my own heart. That's the practice. Notice a moment of grasping and, be mindful of it. Let it go. Don't act on it. Watch that it passes if the conditions are ripe. I'll speak about that practice in a moment. But in relation to the systemic, which has been our topic for a while now, I've been thinking of these poisons or these three fires sometimes as viruses and sometimes as demons or beings. I kind of like viruses in a certain way because there's some way that it's a dis-ease. It's something that brings my system out of homeostasis, out of optimal functioning. And it is so clear that they're not personal. These are archetypal formations. They seem nearly universal. All of the beings that we can track in a kind of psycho-emotional way seem to manifest aspects of these. And particularly throughout the human realm, we find this. And if we believe the texts, throughout the divine realms, we find these. If something like hatred, say, we talked last week about difference and unity. So the impulse to hate or fear that which is different from me. We can think of that as based in our biology as being kind of tribal animals who can deal psychically with a group of about 100 folks, and beyond that we get confused. There's too much difference. But what if we could think about this also as perhaps there's nothing innate about difference that needs to be frightening or hated, but that this quality, once it crept in, in its benign form, it was just part of our self-protective reflexes. It was just part of, saying eat this plant, don't eat that plant. Hang out with those people, not those people. In a very simple way. It's just self-protective, tribal protective. But that natural function runs away or metastasizes or escapes the bounds of wholesomeness and becomes this thing that poisons people's hearts. And if I think of it as a virus, somebody got it really strongly somehow, the self-protective impulse kind of erupted. So perhaps there was a tragedy that was maybe even no one's fault initially. But the response was no, how could this happen? And then that became this force of can we do something about it to restore well-being? And the action perhaps gets bigger. And then it gets bigger on the other side. And of course, we know in conflict that, increased energy on one side increases the energy on the other side. So maybe this develops at a certain point in human history, and it starts to to spread through people in this amplified, more toxic way until it's, you know, one of the most common energies, emotional energies in the world. And then it's not too difficult to look around the world and say, like, are we sick somehow? Are we, like, just like poisoned with this thing that, like, animals don't seem to have it, you know? Animals will protect themselves and their families, but they don't hate other animals, as far as we can do. It doesn't look like it. Their actions don't seem to say that. There's only a few kinds of animals where you might say, like, it sort of looks like there might be that. There's this tribe of ants from the Amazon, a certain kind of fire ant, I believe they are, where they have this thing, they have this aspect of their biology where they sniff each other. And if the one they sniff has the same kind of chemical signature as they do, they're kind. But if that has a different chemical signature of any kind, they just immediately attack. And so I read a kind of wild article about this, about folks who say you can then track how that specific hill, a specific colony of those ants migrated to North America. And you can sense how far that particular colony spread and migrated. If you take an ant from Texas and an ant from California and you put them together and they don't attack each other, they're from the same colony originally. They're immigrants from the same town, basically, in the Amazon. And these researchers were like, okay, well, where's the edge of that? Because inevitably, eventually, they're going to meet tribes of fire ants. They're these super fierce ants that are from a different colony. And when they found, they were kind of tracking through Los Angeles the spread of these fire ants. And when they found the edge, what it was the front line, essentially, where these ants were meeting ants of a different colony. And the researchers said it was shocking that, like, this one colony dominated vast amounts of land. And then, but that when they found the border of that, it was just this one street. They turned onto it, and the street was just a river of ant corpses. And it was like, oh, that's the edge. These other ants were there, and they were just killing each other, because that's what they do. And, and kind of like just strange, horrifying, wild activity. And it's an interesting sort of thought experiment that I just can't say anything more about unless I could be psychic and get into the minds of the ant colony. Maybe some psychics can do that. To ask the question, like, is that hatred? Or is it just a biological impulse that they do that? And if it's just a biological impulse, then, you know, then I'm tempted to say, like, oh, what if we're just fire ants? What if, like, that toxic part of humanity just does that? But the Buddhist system proposes that it's not, you know, and the yogic systems, that the religious systems propose that it's not, that there is an intrinsic kindness that we can tap into that is not that. And that, seemingly unlike those ants, we can learn to tolerate difference. You can actually learn, just by being around difference, to not hate it. So if this whole thing is a purification, it's like, here's these viruses, you know, greed and hatred, delusion in the heart. And they're viruses that are not personal to you. They're not your personality. They're not your sin. They're not your fault. But they are practically the water we swim in. You know, everybody's infected. And humanity has found a cure, right? And of course, it's the Dharma. It's like the great liberation traditions are the cure for that, but it's a difficult cure. Like, it takes all of your effort for your whole life to find that. It's worth it, they say. Those of us that teach it promise you that it's worth it. But it's not easy. It's subtle. But if that's the case, then what we're doing is we're trying to shift in our own systems something that is ancient karma, ancient momentum through us. And you hear this in folks who are trying to shift, like, you know, patterns of family abuse or aspects of the great systemic demons in their own system. You know, I've talked with folks who are saying, like, folks saying, I'm just passionate about removing as much deep racism from my own heart as I can. But as I do that, you know, what I find every single moment that it arises is I find my embeddedness in my family, in my world. You know, it's like, well, my family was like this. This is what we believe as a family. My culture was like this. This is what we believe as a culture. Everything in me has been taught to do this. All the images I've seen in the media and all the stories and all the myths lead to this. So then we get this difficult, but again, it's worth it, task to try to heal from an old virus that's strong and that mutates and that is difficult to uproot. So here's a practice. This is really just refined mindfulness. But it's mindfulness particularly of... it's kind of a couple things mashed together. So one of the foundational mindfulness practices is called Vedana, mindfulness of affect or feeling tone. This is this, for anyone tracking the technicals, this is the second foundation of mindfulness in the Buddhist system. And this teaching says that every sensory perception, every moment of experience comes colored by the assessment of it as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. The Pali words are dukkha, sukha, and neither dukkha nor sukha. Dukkha is pain, suffering, distress, dissatisfaction. Sukha means happiness or ease or well-being. So every single moment's experience is colored by basically an assessment of its charge. And you know, as we talked about this weekend in the trauma course, right, that charge almost certainly comes from, again, is just a playing out of the innate reflex toward protection from danger. So something appears, I don't like it, so that's my nervous system in part saying that could be dangerous. But that becomes, you know, the way I deal with the entire world. The evening light, I kind of like it. The glow from the digital clock is a little too bright, I kind of don't like it. The color of the wall, I kind of like it. The style of the clock, it's a little bit neutral. I think I like it, but some days I don't like it. The texture of the roughness of this particular shirt, at the moment, I don't really like it. The taste of the tea, I like, but the temperature is a little cool, I don't like. I know you, I like you. Empty seats, I don't like that. You know, like whatever. It goes on. But it goes on in a microscopic, flickering, constant way. And it's largely unconscious, right? This is the material that becomes the way we walk through the world. And it becomes the way that, like, in certain places I walk through with my shoulders tense. I don't even notice. Because some part of my system is just tracking, you know, unpleasant, 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 and I'm a little like, eh. Other places I'm like, ooh, I like that, I like that, I like that, I like that, and I want to open up. And it's super unconscious. Unconsciousness leads to the defilements, right, the great poisons. Unconsciousness of pleasure leads to grasping. Right? If I don't notice, oh, I like the wall color, especially the wall color combined with this particular evening light. And ambient sconces, not bad people. Then I could, if I was unconscious of that, and we are all the time, you know, so much of the time, rather than being like, there's a sense perception and it's pleasant, but I'm otherwise neutral in relation to, I'm balanced in relation to it. That sense perception could quickly become, maybe I could have a wall like that in my house. That would be nice, you know. And then, you know, if I don't watch it, like pretty soon I'm, you know, I'm online at 10 p.m. shopping for paint colors. Right? You laugh. You have done it.
Not bad.
Yeah, you know, that's how it works. That's how it works. Likewise, you know, there's something I don't like, right? Tonight, sitting in meditation on just the woolen austere yoga cushions, slightly a little firmer than I'd prefer. And, you know, I could be online shopping for, you know, the perfect buckwheat sitting cushion. So grasping aversion all the time. So this is this basic practice. And this is the practice considered to be like really the hinge toward liberation in the mindfulness system, because this is the thing that turns us away from being hypnotized by our sensory field and into discernment in relation to it, because you actually notice how you're reacting to things all the time. This becomes a microscopic, like, you know, just start noticing it everywhere kind of practice. In the beginning, it's kind of maddening, then you get used to it, and it just becomes the new way you live your life, and it will liberate you from unconsciously grasping and fearing things. So that's one layer. If we want to take them into, you know, working with the big systemic demons, racism, sexism, etc., judgment, what we're doing then is we're noticing Vedana, but we're also noticing essentially mind states and the content of those mind states. So for instance, you know, racism so often expresses itself as in the individual. So racism is a systemic construct, right? No individual person, technically speaking, the way that the word's being used lately by some writers about it, no individual person technically is racist, but individual people have racial bias and they act in ways that are discriminating. But racism, the ism, means that it's a structure. And so it's the whole water you swim in. You know? So then what we're trying to do as practitioners say in relation to racism, my internal work is to uproot racial bias from my system, to untrain myself. And untraining is a word that's being used now. It's a great word because it recognizes that we were trained to do it, right? Infants don't do it. Kids don't do it, you know? And there's that, you know, beautiful and kind of poignant Nina Simone song about, you know, kind of in the voice of a little girl, kind of 5 years old, sounds like, or, you know, somewhere in there, who makes a new friend, and her new friend is so nice and has these particular kind of dolls and lives in this place, and she is so excited about her, and it's so sunny, and I made this new friend. And she goes home and she asks her mother, "Mother, can we play with this new friend?" And this, in the song, Nina doesn't give you the mother's voice. She just leaves some silence. And the child's voice goes, "But Mama, why?" "Oh, okay." Right? It's crushing. It's this terrible reminder that this is totally how it is, but that, like, the racial consciousness has to be awoken. And of course, it's awoken through the toxicity. You know, the child is taught to fear, or even just to make distance, even if it's not fear. Even just the teaching, "You can't play with that person," becomes that. So untraining is a beautiful word for this. Like, you got trained into it, train out of it, you know, and that it's possible to do so. So then if we're trying to untrain ourselves from, say, racial bias, and this is just, that's a stand-in for any of the great systemic ills, but it's a good one nowadays to focus on. What that would mean is it's a mindfulness practice that's tuned into Vedana. It's tuned into Vedana and its content or its referent. In other words, begin to notice race. And when I say begin to, that's an instruction for the privileged, or those, mostly that's an instruction for white folks who may have been trained to not notice race, which is the training for one who's in the oppressor category or the the imagined center. But the training then, for, let's say as an example, white folks who want to unbind racial bias from their own hearts would be to first start noticing race and then really start noticing with mindfulness and a lot of compassion, of course, for yourself and the whole system, for everyone, to notice the little tiny moments where racial bias is present. And it'll be a combination of vedana, so, you know, often an unpleasant, but sometimes a pleasant association, but a pleasant a pleasant or unpleasant association that hinges on the racial difference as being the category that holds that charge. So, you know, I walk into a space and the space contains a mix of folks racially. Of course, that's true. Race is in quotation marks here. Like it's a construct by and large, but there you go. You perceive it visually, culturally, auditorily, etc., through the senses. I walk into a space and there's folks of different races, and my practice then will become to be aware in a heightened way, in an embodied way, embodied mindfulness, of the fluctuations in my state when I perceive each different person. The way that when I see that person, a certain burst of associations happens in me. When I see that person, a burst of associations happens. And to bring into consciousness the assumptions that I have about the folks that I see. And what I'll see, you know, is the ways that I carry my culture, that I carry essentially archetypes, stereotypes, ancient myths, that sort of thing. And what you'll sense as you start doing this are the layers of the way that bias, again, is really a way of talking about like what makes me feel safe and what makes me feel unsafe. So like, I feel safe with that person. I feel unsafe with that person. That person I want to sort of hold in this way. This person I want to get closer to. That person I want to get further away from. And we're bringing into consciousness that which is generally unconscious. That's the whole practice, really. Once you see it consciously, you can make a choice around what to do with it. And for something like racial bias, I'm interested to know what you think about this around the action choice. For me, largely the action choice is to try to keep it in my consciousness and to deflect any habitual actions that might arise as a result of it. Unless I feel like that habit is actually directly, you know, like authentically connected to present moment danger. So I have a practice of, you know, noticing that I was trained into the impulse to like cross the street when like dangerous looking folk were walking toward me. And I want to actually discern what is ancient, not mine racial bias in that, and what is actual perception of danger. And that takes some doing. Because, of course, some people are dangerous and some people aren't. But that's very often not actually based in race. It's based in a number of other things, you know. So I need to be able to discern that. Because I don't want my new action, like, it would be deluded to say, like, oh, I'm going to discern my bias and then I'm going to try to behave the same with everybody, right? Like, what if I'm like, oh, well, I'm just going to hug everybody. That would be my blanket action. Right? It's not appropriate. It's still going to be the case that it's going to be the right action with some people and not the right action for others. So the liberating part, as far as I can tell, is really in the awareness piece, that I see it. And what should happen when I see it is that I feel the sting. The thing that helps us let go of toxic habits is to feel that they hurt. And they're not serving us. So like, I see someone that I kind of fear. I feel how that hurts and it kind of shuts me down. And I'm awake to who they actually are in the real present. And I'm like, oh, this is actually not a dangerous person. And recognizing that, I both consciously try to relax, but then I also try to let in the very real perception of who they actually are so that I autonomically relax. So that it's not just, I'm not just forcing myself to be a certain way, but actually trying to just meet the world as it is, more accurately. So that's a bit of the practice for the privileged or the oppressors or the folks who are in a group that's considered kind of the center or the dominant or that has taken that power. For folks in a class of being who are the oppressed within the system, the core practice is the same, but the structure is different, right? Because the demon is not the same, you know. Like there can still be a fear of or a hatred of someone who is different from you, but if that difference, like the reason that this person is part of the way we know this person is part of the oppressed class is that difference has actually manifested in overt, very real harm for a very long time. And so then coming into mindfulness of it brings you into a different awareness or a different state, right? Like, oh, as I become aware of my place within the racial structure, I become more and more aware of all of the microaggressions or all the systemic forces. And for someone who's oppressed, they're already aware of that, but there can still be a process of, in a sense, sometimes vocalizing it is appropriate, sometimes getting support in like telling the story of it and being respected and heard and saying like, yes, this is true, being validated that this is true. And then liberation from it is a different pathway because it may actually be that liberation from the mind state of racial awareness is not the most necessary piece, but actually just straight up material liberation from the conditions of oppression. And so then the work is different. Mindfulness of mind states is the same process, but the action you might take could be very different. So I'm curious to reflect with you what you think about that difference from a traditional perspective. You know, the core practice would have to be the same. It's always presented that way, that like you get some concentration, you get your ethics in order, and then you become aware of toxic mind states. You renounce the forces that support them in you, you let go, and you move toward clearer or more tranquil or more peaceful mind states. So that's the pathway for everyone, but how we act in relationship to them must be different if we're talking about folks in different positions of power in the world. So that last piece particularly, I'm excited to kind of think out loud with you because it departs from the classical teachings in a way that's really, it's really up right now in activist circles. Like there's a lot of beautiful, you know, Buddhist activism, yogic activism, faith-based activism around, you know, racism and patriarchy, structural inequity. But very often to engage in that activism, to support those discourses, like discourses that are naming oppressions and fighting against them, the inner purification aspect, let's say, of Buddhism, sometimes seems to be sidelined. And I might propose that there's ways that that's just appropriate, because until the material conditions of safety are attained for a person or a set of people, there's not actually the basic conditions for that unbinding to happen. Because that unbinding, of course, or not of course, but that binding requires in the nervous system the perception of safety. Right? So to override my perception of being threatened, I have to actually have some basis of feeling safe enough in the world to do so. To be like, oh, I'm going to relax my shoulders as I walk past this person. It's a privilege to be able to do that. And if I'm a person who has been, you know, pulled over by the police 50 times in the last year and they drive by, I could do that practice. I'm going to relax. But actually, it's probably the wrong instruction, you know. So if this is true, this distinction that I'm making, then I think that some of the implications would be that the subtle internal purification process, like really trying to uproot the ancient seeds of greed, hatred, and delusion in my own heart, is either tremendously difficult for one in the oppressed position, or in some cases inappropriate at certain times for one in those positions, or takes a distinct set of other conditions to manifest. And there's some beautiful counterexamples to this that are very interesting. You know, folks on death row, surrounded by violence in the prison, who, you know, get in contact with like one teacher or read a couple books and just say, I'm going to do this and start practicing, you know, vigorously, even in these what we might think of as terrible conditions, and attain a profound shift in their own heart, uprooting these demons, curing themselves of the virus of hatred. So it's clearly possible. But my guess would be that there had to be some supportive condition in those cases that enabled the mind to turn from the need to protect oneself from threat in a constant way, to be able to turn toward this subtler unbinding. Because you have to become vulnerable to do so. And that takes some support in whatever way. So, bless you. So your thoughts. Unbinding the deep biases from our hearts, how it's different in the oppressor and oppressed positions. Anything this bubbles up for you this evening. And if not directly that, really, as we always do, you know, anything about your practice that's up that you'd like to bring in.
Thank you. As always, it's terrific. Thank you so much.
Thank you, dear.
I want to say thank you because it's very enlightening to be able to hear that and read about it and make it very approachable. Mm. When you speak about how we have the three demons or fires, and to hear you say the position that we have from oppressor or from oppressed, and to acknowledge that the awakening and the mindfulness that we can live, not just exist, and have a choice to untrain ourselves in different scenarios is very easy for me to respect and really be a soldier of it, because I feel that reading, and I feel that reaching out to resources is the only way to actually transform from inside and get this opportunity to untrain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading a book called The Sacred Ego.
Mm-hmm.
And a friend mentioned to me because we were talking about emotional intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that. Maybe everybody else knows it. But the heart is has its own nervous system.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain, obviously, is the IQ which we are so respectful of.
Mm-hmm.
When in fact, I realized because of this that it all works in a very counterproductive if we are not aware that the master is the heart.
Mm-hmm.
And ideally, it would be helpful for us to know that the brain is in service of the heart,
mm-hmm.
that the intelligence of the heart is superior to the head. And that's where all the insanity would evolve in the mind that creates those three demons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm so thankful that I can see how it's really comes from different ways, from different perspectives, and it all boils down to the way we're choosing to be. Are we going to work with the head or are we going to work from the heart?
Mm-hmm.
If I can share with you, because I'm in small
groups. Please do.
My daughter wanted to visit this weekend, and on Sunday night it was dump. Her fiancé and his two nephews with their dog, who was a pit bull and lost his leg and is just in a very dire situation, in my little apartment, and take off to Denver to meet her friend. I thought to myself, this is just not working in my psyche, because my son is schizophrenic, he has his room. How is there going to slumber party in the living room? It would be uncomfortable for the 11-year-old and the 14-year-old to come to a place they've never been to, and we would be uncomfortable because we won't really have a good rapport. We don't know the people other than her fiancé. And before I went to sleep, and she was telling me that she doesn't think like that. When people are in need, you open the door. But both myself and my husband and my son, we're just feeling like, whoa. We thought it was just going to be her fiancé and the dog. Now she's saying it's going to be the other two. How are we going to do it? With bedding, sleeping, mattresses, we got to organize it. Okay, we'll pitch in, we said, for a hotel so they can stay one more night. Anyway, I was reading a little bit of that Sacred Ego before I went to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And the next morning I texted her and apologized. And I told her that it comes from both me and my husband, because I spoke to Brian in the morning. And I explained to him, they're not really all there, meaning that they own their life and they know how to manage their life. And they're reaching out for help. And we have to be selfless in order for us to be in peace. And just know it's my daughter and it's her fiancé. It doesn't matter. Oh, no, the kids, we parents, we know how to be parents. And it's just, it shifted in me. My state of mind was, it doesn't matter. If it's your daughter, there's nothing you can do to be in peace unless you agree with anything she needs. It's just like a sellout. I mean, when we're parents, and it's just another.
Unfortunately, it's true. Yeah. Crazy. Yeah.
She's probably going to be able to come. She's figuring out she needs to travel from South California if she's going to drive down, because she didn't want them to drive along with the dog being so in that situation. But if she can drive with them, they won't come. So thank you for listening. I just wanted to share it because we're a small group.
Yeah.
And I've unloaded.
Well, it feels like, you know, you're describing a shift in your own perception from, you know, perceiving a situation as negative.
Chaotic.
Which sounds, at least, you know, not untrue. Like, totally still could be completely chaotic, and it might even still be quite unpleasant. But the shift in your willingness to act a certain way, you know, based in your ethics, based in your heart, changes your experience of the whole thing, even if it's actually just as much a mess.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You know, and they do, they're there for the net, and then they go, and you're all like, whew, what was that? You know, that the thing that gets, you know, nothing in the yogic teachings in the Dharma says that you know, when you practice, things are going to get more comfortable. I mean, they do, but that challenging things are going to stop happening. Mm-hmm. But the shift you made is exactly the kind of shift that practice is pointing toward, which is that it's a shift in your orientation in relation to something. And you're like, oh, this is what's happening, you know? And your parents, you know how to respond. You care for the kids, and, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
They're 11 and 14. They don't even need mattresses. Just, like, throw them on the couch. Make them some popcorn. They'll be happy. It'll be great.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, I'm glad you're here. Thank you. The same. For telling us a little story. That's good. Yeah, other thoughts? Yeah.
I think that in relation to the question of whether or not we should put aside Buddhist teachings before we can use them in like the context of fighting systemic racism, I think there's a fairly big difference between dismantling racist structures and committing violence against them. I think you can dismantle those structures in a way that isn't violent. And maybe that takes a little bit more work and a little bit more consciousness. But I think in that way, there's a way to use the Buddhist teachings in order to do that. And I don't know if anyone's ever heard of a guy named Paulo Freire.
Oh,
wow. I've been reading him a little bit lately, and I think of his, he wrote a book called Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and a lot of it is about not responding to violence with violence, because that kind of just, it removes it kind of erases the love and the original intent. That goes into wanting to dismantle violent structures.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I think about when you ask that question.
Yeah, he's so good, right? Mm-hmm. What a pleasure. I'm so glad you bring his name in. And there's this beautiful way that, you know, responding to oppression from a place of wholesomeness or wholesome practice. And I don't want to assert that always means from a classically nonviolent perspective. I tend to share that perspective, but I also tend to come from a more or less privileged position. And there's critique from various wings of aspects of that. But agreeing with that from a Buddhist perspective, saying like, oh, what if our practice is actually just to continue to cultivate the wholesome states in our own heart. So I'm going to respond to this, you know, intolerable situation from the place of practice, you know, as best I can. Meeting, you know, essentially a flare-up of the virus, not by amplifying it with the same, you know, but meeting it somehow with its antidote.
That talks about too is just the internalized oppression, yeah. And that's what came up for me is that I know as a woman, I'm infected by sexism, the sexist virus too.
Yeah.
Even as I am materially or impacted by patriarchal structures.
Yep.
So there's still that internal work of. Yeah. Untraining myself.
Absolutely.
And I think that goes for anyone who's in the marginalized or oppressed position is that there's the dismantling of your own internal structures too.
Yes.
And resisting
the
structures themselves. And I think that like affinity groups can be a way of of creating a sense of safety so that you can do that internal work and ready for the act of resistance.
Yeah.
And one reason why we might need it in also in Buddhist circles where there's sanghas that are specific to marginalized groups.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad you're bringing in the internalized oppression piece. That's absolutely that side of that thing, you know, to work on. It's one of the ways I love the virus metaphor because oh, of course you have it too. You know, it was passed on to you. And you know, and of course, yes, to the affinity groups model. That's also, you know, like when we're talking about safety as a precondition for like nervous system restoration, that's often what we'll talk about in relation to systemic oppression. It's like you have to have some spaces or groups or places that are protected, you know, from that violence. And so then being with folks who are within the category or who are safe to allow the nervous system to drop, to settle, to see itself more clearly. In order then to be able to go out and maintain action.
The other thing that came up for me is I work at a preschool right across the street. Mm. And we're talking in the two-year-old group about how to address race with young children. We were talking about it in the parent group. It's really important to some of the families and when we do have an anti-bias social justice stance. And so you're talking about it's a mixed racial group. And that brought up, and there are people with varying understandings of racial conditioning, which brings a lot of complexity because then it's about the people that we all care most about, which is their children. So it brings a lot of charge into the room and being able to work skillfully at holding all of that.
Yeah.
Is something I'm just thinking about. Like how do we bridge all of that complexity? And there's nothing really happening in the child group right now around race.
Right, so it's not in crisis mode. Like we have to act.
It's not in crisis mode. Yeah, but there's clearly a this is important, and we want to support identity development and be and get to some shared awareness.
Yeah, absolutely. That work is so important. I mean, especially like you know if you can do something that teaches well the two-year-olds, you know, plants a good seed there. That's huge, of course. I hope that this kind of talk around racial bias that I think the Buddhist tradition is particularly good at seeing things as impersonal because it sees everything as impersonal. But you know, this kind of talk is appearing in all sorts of places right now, that my hope is frames these things fully enough as like historical, contextual, you know, ancient, cultural, impersonal forces that kind of diffuses what seems like one of the main things that gets in the way of those kind of conversations, which is blame, you know, folks feeling attacked or shamed or, you know, or personally blamed in some way for something. And, you know, all of the layers of like, you know, white fragility and that come up in those conversations, I would hope can be somewhat diffused by really establishing this view that, you know, the structural construct, racism, is not the same as, you know, the action of discrimination or the felt sense of bias, and that the and that bias is nobody's fault. You know, that it's just, and when that lands, the thing I see in folks when that lands is I see folks get just much less kind of defended around it. And there can be just this like, oh, of course, like, this is terrible. Here's how it shows up in me. Here's how it shows up in you. Everyone carries it a little bit in different ways. So what's, it becomes then not like, you know, how a given person, you know, what a given person's work to do is like, oh, you have to learn this or you have to do this, mm-hmm. but more like what can we as a collective do to act in a way that reflects our shared values, to the extent that we do share values.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks for doing that work in a preschool. It's good. It's good work to do. Any other thoughts before we close today?
I had a dinner with a gentleman who's been doing social justice, economic justice work for about 30 years. And he happens to be Black, and One thing he shared with me is that he has lost hope. And I think he was with me mostly because he wanted my, I don't know if optimism is the right word, and if I'll weave in different things. I have personally said that I'm not really so much an outer activist. I'm more of an inner alchemist. And we need both. You know, that some people are drawn more to the, and I've done things, you know, like somebody else actually changed them. Marian, you are. But I don't think of, I think of the inner, right? Like I have this fascination about that the root cause is inside the human operating system. And if we shift that, that's the game changer for all the outer outcomes. And tonight, as I was listening to you, it's like, huh, you know, if I wanted to do something to really have people all get along, would I put a bunch of people of all different backgrounds and say, hey, let's meditate together? And the answer was probably not. That wouldn't be my first instinct.
Yeah.
As, right, to, there'd be other ways of, sort of harmonizing, democratizing sameness, food, music, disease, stuff like that. This gentleman said that he had gone to, so he had lost hope that there were younger people in the work that felt like integration was not desirable. And that, so like, this catch-22 with the affinity groups becoming worse, tribalism, paradoxes all over the place. And there was a very popular training that they were all going to, and there was this, like the rallying cry was, all white people are racist, was the, like the thing that they were all supposed to say out loud.
It's heartbreaking how long and dense the historical process is. There's this movement right now in academic race studies, in some ways, or at least I found out about it in my doctoral program. A group of philosophers right now, a movement called Afro-pessimism, that essentially says that the race consciousness that was created on the planet I'm going to paraphrase it wrong, so forgive me, proper Afro-pessimists out there, that the race consciousness created on the planet as a result of European colonialism and then the transatlantic slave trade is categorically, like, definitional for the planet right now. And that actually to unbind that would unbind everything about every civilization, because no civilization is free from it. And that particularly, you know, the civilizations that participated centrally in it, which is, you know, Europe and the Americas and Africa, can't be healed from it because it's foundational to their existence. You can't change the United States to be a non-racist place because that is what it was founded to be. So there's a layer of that discourse that's very intelligent and well worked out, mm-hmm. and heartbreaking mm-hmm. in many ways, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And also mysterious to say, like, what are we even talking about in a yeah. certain way? Like, we're on a planet where, you know, somewhere around 500 years ago or so, one set of folks, a few sets of folks, got so technologically powerful that they were able to essentially control the vast majority of the rest of the cultures on the planet. And they did so with such horrifying efficiency in a short period of time that the consequences for global well-being have been perhaps, you know, if not certainly irreversibly altered, but the arc of recovering from that, you know, some folks say can only happen once, like, all of the nation states are gone. Like, all of the current borders and the identities are all bound up in this thing. What do you do? Like, that's the history of humanity now, is in this thing. And this is not meant to give the state of hopelessness, although in Buddhism, hopelessness is considered a good state. But to really, this would be a question, you know, that this man would be bringing up, and the kind of inquiry that you're suggesting is really an inquiry toward even asking, like, the thing that feels to me like the ideal that we're going for, where'd that come from? What is that? You know, is that just me wishing that somehow we could just, like, erase the ills of the past and kind of be better? And that's, it's never worked like that.
So this is either, depending on the context, it could be, people could perceive this as annoying or La La Land or whatever, but this was part of our conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm going to grab things and skip over things. So I used to live in Santa Barbara, Lily White. Landlord was a raging Trump fan. From Italy, spent a lot of time in South Africa, etc. And I chose, and I was going through a recovery of dark night of the soul, alchemy, etc. while I was living there. And I chose to have really amazing, compassionate listening conversations with him many times over. It was a great practice, and we're human beings. And I saw him, and he actually used the N-word once. My God. About Obama. It was wild. And I did speak back to that. I didn't just sit there with a smile on my face. No way. But anyway, so there's that little tip that I'll skip. And then, this is going to make sense, but there's a story of, I took a flight, the 13-hour flight to Europe a while ago, and there was a screaming baby on the plane. And I promise you, a few years ago, I would have been eye-rolling and like, oh God, I'm stuck on a plane with this kid. Da, da, da. What happened in my body
didn't talk myself into it, wasn't like a self-coaching in or whatever, but I just, like my first absolute organic whole body response was such love and compassion for the screaming child. Like I was her, she was me. And the alchemist geek in me went, oh, wow, this is my new normal. This is my first response to something that I would have hated once upon a time. And I don't know if it's going to make any sense, but I've moved to Berkeley. I used to live in Chicago. I'm way more like normalized and stabilized living here. I'm happy about that. And I swear to God, I did not go on Craigslist and say, hey, I want to live with Black people. But I found a place for the first 2 months, and now where I've been living for a few months, and I've been living in completely Black households. Mm-hmm. Well, not completely. Like, the owner is Black, and now I'm living in a sort of a melting pot household. We've got, you know, various groups all represented in different rooms.
Yeah, it's mysterious.
And I just feel like there's some mysterious cosmic force that's helping with the...
You know, we need all the mysterious cosmic forces we can get to help with this one. So, you know, absolutely. It's like that.